the Park Service and the federal government can't treat the parks, preserves, and refuges in Alaska like they do down south.
The Supreme Court hands an Alaska moose hunter a partial victory. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, lawmakers confront the stages of grief when grappling with a $4 billion deficit.
People in that stages of grief model are in the bargaining phase. In my opinion, most Alaskans are there.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. Join the Salmon Project this month as they highlight the salmon lives of Alaskans and communities across the state. Find them on Facebook or visit salmonlife.org to make sure you don't miss these powerful stories. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
In a decision released this morning, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a partial victory to Alaska moose hunter John Sturgeon in his case against the National Park Service. The High Court voted 8-0 to reject a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision against Sturgeon. The case, heard by the High Court in January, challenged a Park Service hovercraft ban applied on the Nation River within the Yukon-Charley River's National Preserve. Sturgeon was pleased with the Supreme Court's ruling.
What they basically said is that the Park Service's interpretation of 103C and ANILCA was not correct, they need to go back to the drawing board and redo it.
The section of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act that Sturgeon's case hinges on says non-federal property, like Alaska rivers, are not subject to rules meant solely for surrounding parks. Sturgeon says the High Court's decision backs ANILCA's protection of activities like boating and hunting.
The Park Service and the federal government can't treat the parks, preserves, and refuges in Alaska like they do down south. That Alaska, because of ANILCA, was meant to be different.
Numerous conservation groups back the Park Service's ability to regulate activities like hovercraft use in Alaska parks. Katie Strong is with Trustees for Alaska, which represented 13 conservation organizations in the Sturgeon case. Strong describes the Supreme Court ruling as incredibly limited.
All that the Supreme Court said was that the Ninth Circuit's reasoning was not valid. And then the Supreme Court made no legal rulings on the rest of the legal basis for deciding whether the Park Service can regulate rivers within parks.
Strong notes that ANILCA can also be used to justify regulation of Alaska rivers.
The Ninth Circuit will have to look at ANILCA as a whole and say, well, would it make sense for Congress to protect these national parks, to protect these rivers, and in the same statute take away the Park Service's authority to do so?
Strong lists numerous other federal laws that could come into play in the case, including federal reserved water rights, the Submerged Lands Act, and the Equal Footing Doctrine. Both Strong and Sturgeon expect that it will be at least a year before the Ninth Circuit rules again on the issue. The Army's decision this week not to proceed with a planned troop cut at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson is unusual. For at least the next year, Anchorage won't have to face the economic hit it's been expecting since the Army announced it would be part of a 40,000 soldier reduction last year. But there's no relief for communities in the lower 48 who were told they'd lose troops in the same decision.
To actually overturn a decision like this is fairly remarkable.
Michael O'Hanlon is a national security expert at the Brookings Institute and a former defense analyst at the Congressional Budget Office.
This is pretty good job by the Alaska delegation, I have to say. I mean, I think they had a good argument on their side.
O'Hanlon says the cut of 2,600 J-Bear troops dismantling the 425 Airborne Brigade never made much sense in light of the Obama administration's plan to focus more on the Asia-Pacific.
I think it's probably true that a lot of people had some input in this, not least the senators from Alaska. But I think that once the debate began, logic was on their side, and they did a good job of pointing out this apparent disconnect between the Asia-Pacific rebalance priority of the Obama administration with the proposed cut in the brigade in Alaska.
Senator Dan Sullivan used his position on the Senate Armed Services Committee to repeatedly raise that argument. Senator Lisa Murkowski is also in an influential position with a seat on the Defense Subcommittee of the Appropriations Panel. The senators often discuss the cuts in the context of Russia's Arctic buildup. O'Hanlon says he thinks those arguments were less persuasive than the 425's ability to respond on the Korean Peninsula and elsewhere in Asia. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, which runs the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, is splitting with its longtime provider of oil spill prevention and response services in Prince William Sound. As APRN's Rachel Waldholtz reports, in a region where the memory of the Exxon Valdez oil spill remains fresh, that decision is raising concerns.
Right now, Crowley Marine Services provides the tugboats that escort oil tankers out of Prince William Sound. It also manages the oil spill response barges that would be first on the scene if there's ever an accident. The company has held at least part of that contract for more than 25 years, and it's provided all the ship escort and response vessel services for the last decade. Donna Shantz heads up the Regional Citizens Advisory Council, which was set up in the aftermath of the Exxon Valdez. She says what's at stake is more than just a contract.
It's a key oil spill prevention and response measure for Prince William Sound, really put in place after the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill. So it's a very, very important role.
But Crowley's contract is up for renewal. And last week, they announced in a press release that their bid had been rejected. It's not yet clear who might take their place. The bidding process isn't complete. Shantz says she and many others in Valdez were taken by surprise, because the current system is working pretty well.
The fact that we haven't had a major oil tanker incident is a pretty good indication. I think Crowley's done a really good job.
And Crowley has made clear the breakup isn't their choice. Representatives wouldn't speak by phone, citing the sensitivity of the issue. But in a press release, CEO Tom Crowley said his company bid this contract very aggressively and is extremely disappointed. The company couldn't offer any details as to why their bid wasn't accepted, and Alyeska spokesperson Kate Dugan says she can't comment while the bidding process is still underway.
It's a competitive landscape, and that's all I can really say about that. The details of the contract, not just the contract itself, but the whole process of how and why we make decisions like this is to protect the privacy of the bidders and to get the most competitive deal we can get.
Dugan says the company is committed to protecting Prince William Sound. That's why it started the bidding process well before the current contract expires in 2018.
We were deliberate in that so that we could make sure that any transition, if there was going to be a transition, would be thoughtful and honor the commitment we have to Prince William Sound.
Dugan couldn't confirm who else is in the running or whether more than one company is still being considered. But Louisiana-based Edison Schuest Offshore told the Alaska Dispatch News that they are competing for the contract. Edison Schuest has operations worldwide, but they're perhaps best known in Alaska for the AVIC tugboat, which was pulling Shell's Arctic drill rig, the Kulik, across the Gulf of Alaska in 2012 when the rig broke loose and grounded off Kodiak. Meanwhile, Crowley currently employs about 250 people in Valdez. Alan Cote is national president of the Inland Boatmen's Union of the Pacific, which represents about 150 deckhands, engineers, and cooks working for Crowley. He says it would be hard for any company to absorb more than 200 people, and his members are worried.
Especially now with the reduction in oil exploration and production in Alaska. So, you know, it's really a catch-22 for these workers, the union and the company.
Shantz says the Citizens Council will work with whoever comes in, but no matter who it is, she says, they will have a steep learning curve.
We don't know yet, but we are assuming we're going to have new tugs coming in, new barges, new people, and just pulling all those pieces together and making sure that the prevention and response in place isn't compromised during that transition process is going to be significant.
Crowley will continue providing services through June 2018. Alyeska expects to announce its new contractor by early summer. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the ski and snowboard freeride competition gets underway in Haines.
Just being this place, it's just far away and in the middle of nature, so it's been a powerful competition.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know that Pick, Click, Give helps over 600 nonprofits across Alaska? Over the years, Alaskans like you have donated over $13 million to organizations benefiting everything from our youth to the arts to healthcare. You've even donated to public radio to keep quality programming alive in Alaska. A small part of your PFD can make a big impact when you Pick, Click, Give. This message sponsored by the Alaska Community Foundation and Pick, Click, Give.
A proposal to allow state government to dip into permanent fund earnings is advancing in the legislature. The Senate Finance Committee heard details today from Anchorage Republican Senator Liesl McGuire. Similar to a plan from Governor Bill Walker, McGuire's bill would pay for much of state government using fund earnings.
In my opinion, we have to continue with strategic cuts to the budget, but we can't cut our way out of it. And that's why you need a fundamental restructure to the permanent fund.
McGuire's bill has been revised over the past month. One amendment would change the basis for Alaskans' annual dividend payments. They're currently based on fund earnings. McGuire wanted to base them on oil and gas royalties. Under the amendment, dividends would be based on a combination of fund earnings, royalties, and the constitutional budget reserve. And another amendment would prevent a cut to dividends this year. In future years, dividends would be as low as $1,000. McGuire says Alaskans don't want to see dividend cuts, but they've gone through the first two stages of grief over the budget, denial and anger.
What we're hearing, again, is people in that stages of grief model are in the bargaining phase. In my opinion, most Alaskans are there. They understand that both because the private sector is interrelated to the health of the public sector, they also understand that without basic government services, they wouldn't really want to live in Alaska. So why would other young people come here and want to grow it?
A key difference with Governor Walker's plan is that McGuire's would bring in less money to the state. McGuire estimates that the state would draw roughly $2 billion annually from the permanent fund earnings. Governor Walker's bill would draw $3.3 billion annually. Unlike McGuire's bill, Walker would draw money from oil production taxes and the state's constitutional budget reserve into the permanent fund earnings reserve account. Neither plan would entirely close the state's budget gap this year. The Senate Finance Committee will hear public testimony on Walker's and McGuire's permanent fund bills tomorrow and Thursday. Opponents of the Kinnick Arm Bridge project are claiming a victory. Federal transportation officials have turned down the state's request for a loan for the seventh time. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
A February letter from the U.S. Department of Transportation explains the federal government is putting on hold its consideration of the state's current bridge plan. The letter also indicates that the state needs to reduce its estimates of traffic and revenue concerning the bridge. Jeremy Woodrow, a State Department of Transportation spokesperson, says the denial of the loan does not kill the bridge project. He says DOT is in the negotiating process for a loan from federal transportation officials.
And what do you expect with any negotiation? There's a lot of back and forth between the two parties before you can reach an agreement. So the letter that we recently received was them saying that they aren't ready to process the loan and they need more information from the state of Alaska before we can keep moving along this process. It was expected. It didn't come as a shock to the department. It was just expected as part of that negotiation process.
The state is seeking a $375 million Transportation Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act loan, that's called a TIFIA loan, to finance construction of the bridge. But the letter to Alaska DOT indicates the state's proposal poses too many risks. The state is prohibited from issuing bonds to pay for construction of the bridge without the federal loan, according to state legislation passed in 2014. Last year, Governor Walker approved continuing with the bridge project under a restructured financing plan. But Jamie Kenworthy, author of the blog Kinnick Arm Facts, opposes the bridge. Kenworthy says the state has spent upwards of $2 million on consultants to revise estimates of toll revenue that would pay for the first phase of bridge construction. Kenworthy says the traffic estimates are exaggerated to show a traffic projection that ensures enough tolls to pay for the project.
Let me tell you how exaggerated and aggressive they are. The state demographer thinks that there'll be 162,000 people living in the Mat-Su in 2042. The Kibada number is 60% more growth than everybody else. 60%.
Kenworthy says that both houses of the legislature have passed their operating budgets for the next year, budgeting $1.6 million for the bridge. Those budgets now sit in conference committee, but Kenworthy says there is $168 million in federal funds now available for the bridge project, but the state does not have the matching funds necessary to use it.
The whole structure of House Bill 23, which was the last Kibada bill, was you need to get the TIFIA loan to trigger the state financial commitment. There's no reason why legislators can't recommit that money in the capital budget, in the operating budget this year, and put more money on the street this summer.
Kenworthy also says the letter from federal transportation officials indicates that the state has not made it to the negotiation stage regarding a TIFIA loan. That's not true. According to Judy Daugherty, DOT's director for the Knik Bridge project, Daugherty says the TIFIA loan is only dependent on projected tolls from the bridge. And she says DOT will respond to federal highway officials with new information.
We're preparing a response for TIFIA that will show them the break-even case, and that would be how low the tolls and the revenue can be in order to still cover the TIFIA loan. And what we're finding is that it can be even lower than our extreme downside case, as much as 30% lower than the extreme downside.
Daugherty says that data has just been completed and will be sent to federal authorities at month's end. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
State and federal officials are meeting in Anchorage this week on a study plan for the proposed Susitna-Wetana Dam in the Mat-Su Valley. Emily Ford, a spokesperson for the Alaska Energy Authority, says the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission must approve every aspect of the study plan before further action can be taken. Ford says the study plan is based on information gathered in 2013 and 14. The Susitna Dam project was put on hold shortly after Governor Walker was elected, but last summer, the hold was lifted. Ford says the information was filed with FERC a year and a half ago, and now FERC will review it. The federal agency must give the go-ahead for the study program as part of the pre-licensing process for the dam. But some groups opposed to the plan for the dam say the study process is flawed. Sam Snyder with Trout Unlimited says the state has spent more than $193 million on studies for the dam at a time when the state's budget crisis is unresolved. The outcome of the meetings will determine if AEA can proceed with the pre-license process necessary for moving ahead on the project.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. At Alaska Pacific University, you will be inspired by the beauty of Alaska, motivated by devoted faculty, and surrounded by independent-minded, creative students pursuing their higher education goals. There's no time like the present to find out what they are all about. It's time to experience APU. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Extreme skiers and snowboarders sped down Haines Mountains on Monday in the fourth stop of the Free Ride World Tour. The International Alpine Sports Tournament made the long trek back to Haines after its Alaska debut last year. As KHNS's Emily Files reports, it hasn't been totally smooth sailing. Haines poses challenges athletically and logistically.
Hello and welcome to the fourth stop of the Free Ride World Tour. My name's Ed Lee. This is Martin Winkler. Are you excited, Marty?
Oh, yes, I am.
On Monday morning, athletes in bright pink and yellow snow gear got ready to tackle a steep mountain face near Little Jarvis Glacier. Videographers circled in helicopters, but fans were left in the dark. The Freeride's live stream, which broadcasts the competition around the world, wasn't working because of a satellite problem. Tom Winter is a spokesman for the tour.
It's painful. It's painful to have this happen, but it's a learning process working in an environment like Haines.
It's called The Last Frontier for good reason.
Despite the live stream troubles, organizers decided to go ahead with the competition.
Okay, well, we've got Camille Armand kicking things off.
Frenchman Armand was followed by American and first-time freeride competitor Jonathan Penfield.
A little bit of hesitation there. Oh, no. Going down.
And that gives you an idea of the gradient now. The Tomahawk does not let up.
I crashed at the top of my run, but had a really enjoyable ride the rest of the way down.
Penfield says Alaska presents unique challenges for the riders. It's all backcountry here. There are no ski resorts with lifts to help athletes practice. That requires a helicopter.
Yeah, it's definitely harder. Normally you're able to warm up riding a few days before, but for me, today was the first time I've snowboarded in a week.
Penfield was up against Austrian Flo Orli, who's in his 16th and last year competing.
Going for it again with a grab.
Oh, huge!
Ian sticking it!
I think at a pretty fast top part, and then in the lower third of the face, there's a big rollover, and I took a little bit too much speed, actually, and flew for like 25 meters plus, and I landed it.
Orli took the bronze for his run in Haines.
Oh, and he's hyped, yes.
You saw the fists clench up and woo!
An Alaskan guest athlete, also known as a wildcard competitor, took the gold in men's snowboarding. Ryland Bell showed his familiarity with the Haines terrain by racking up a score of 95 out of 100.
Being sloughed through there, but holding on.
Rookie Logan Pahoda of Canada took the top score in the men's ski category. He was joined by Frenchman Loic Colum-Paton and American Drew Tabke in the top three. As for the female snowboarders, Swiss Anne-Fleur Mochter made what commentator Lee said was the most impressive line he's seen in a long time for snowboard women.
And she's going big!
That was really big. Biggest there we've seen from the women,
and
she's
controlled
puts
it together.
The speed.
That is a winning line so far.
Mochter took first place in her category. Her friend, Austrian Eva Volkner, took the gold in women's skiing. Mochter told KHNS before the competition that she doesn't strategize her runs. She just goes out and has fun.
Me, I'm just so glad to be here. I just want to make sure I'm having a good time. And at the end of that, my one day of competing, I will remember amazing excitement, speed, joy of riding, and just make sure to make the best out of it in my own memories.
Italian skier Arianna Tricomi created her first Alaska skiing memories this week. The rookie skier put up a fight against the more experienced Volkner. She earned third place
really
in her category.
To make the most of that. Oh, and she's holding on.
Just
the way the mountains are, it's different. They're big, they're powerful, and just be in this place, it's just far away and in the middle of nature, so it's been a powerful competition.
Tricomi says the power and beauty that comes from the remote mountains is enough to make the challenges they present worth it. Apparently, freeride organizers agree with her. Haines Tourism Director Leslie Ross says it's likely that they'll come back next year. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
While commercial fishermen were on the water anxiously awaiting the next herring opening in Sitka, some residents gathered on land for a traditional Tlingit ceremony. The blessing of herring rock happens every year to get the fish to come back to the sound to spawn. KCAW's Brielle Schaefer has the story.
For centuries, the Kiksati clan has honored the beginning of herring season in the spring by blessing herring rock. It was at this rock, which originally stood on the waterfront of the Indian village, where herring traditionally began their spawn. Nels Lawson is a Tlingit elder.
This time of year was very significant to our people. It was the arrival of the herring on our shores meant the arrival of new food for our homes.
In that respect, little has changed. The small group of residents and tribal citizens gathered at the ceremony are waiting for the fish to spawn to collect their tasty eggs. However, spawning patterns have changed, and the large herring rock has been relocated on shore. It now sits outside the Shikaquan Nakahiti. Rachel Moreno, Sitka Tribe of Alaska Tribal Council member, says poor returns in recent years and fewer spawning areas make the blessing especially meaningful.
We bless it so that we won't have such a hard time getting them to come back. This is one of the last places that herring spawn. And so it's a very important anchor for that species and for our traditions, for our people to enjoy the harvest of the herring eggs.
She says she likes to enjoy her roe with seal oil and soy sauce, something she's looking forward to after the herring spawn and the subsistence roe on hemlock harvest. Robbie Littlefield did the honors of the blessing this year. She poured salt water from the channel over the rock in memory of her husband, John Littlefield, a subsistence activist. She says she's fueling up her boat in preparation for the harvest.
It's not time to put branches in the water yet, but it's time to start looking because you never know for sure where they're going to spawn. And especially with the commercial harvesters pounding on them, they're running away. And sometimes they scatter for a week at a time.
Competition over the herring resource has created tension between the commercial and subsistence interests. Littlefield, along with other traditional harvesters, feels that commercial fishing has a greater impact on herring than the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's data suggests. She's concerned about the future of the ecosystem.
They're at the base of the pyramid. Everything depends on herring. And when you cut off the bottom of the pyramid, you've got a problem.
Patty Dick teaches sixth grade science at Blatchley Middle School. She sees the blessing of herring rock as an important tradition, one she always teaches her students about.
There are a lot of changes that are occurring right now in our ocean. And we are in the process of living through these changes. And so every year that these herring return, it is really special.
And that's a blessing in itself. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Brielle Schaefer.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Ross in Fairbanks, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Rachel Waldholtz and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Emily Files in Haines, and Brielle Schaefer in Sitka. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future. Join the Salmon Project this month as they highlight the salmon lives of Alaskans and communities across the state. Find them on Facebook or visit salmonlife.org to make sure you don't miss these powerful stories. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
The Elder Mentor Program is designed to bring the wisdom, cultural values, and resilience of Alaskan elders into the classroom and into the community by supporting educators and children. They're looking for low-income elders, age 55 or older, to serve as positive, supportive role models for children. Elder Mentors serve through the National Senior Corps Program. Mentor information at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.